Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. I am super excited today to welcome my lovely friend Shelley onto the podcast. She is a wonderful doula and biomechanics expert, and we are going to be talking about birth and breathing and biomechanics today. Welcome, Shelley.
Oh, thank you, Erin. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to see you.
It's been a long time coming having you come on the podcast, by the way. I've been dying to get you on, so I'm very excited to finally have you here to pick your brain and share your knowledge.
Oh, I think it's always great to share information and learning about kind of things that we sort of touch on and like understanding the reason behind why things are helpful can be so good.
Yeah,
so hopefully I'll provide some of that today.
I'm sure you will. Before we start, do you want to just introduce yourself a little bit for anyone that doesn't know who you are?
So hi everybody, my name's Shelley and I am on social media as The Serenity Doula, and I've been a doula for nearly 18 years now, and I also have a background in osteopathic and naturopathic medicine. I studied at university and then taught at university, so I've been teaching about movement of the body, about techniques of biomechanic techniques for that amount of time now, for a long period of time, and I've sort of more specialized it into birth more recently because that's the area that I love and I'm really interested in.
And you're really good at sharing that knowledge as well, by the way. Like, you're, if anyone doesn't follow you on TikTok, they need to go and follow you on TikTok, because your posts are fantastic. They are humorous and they are witty and very informative as well at the same time. So you're very creative. So people need to go and give you a follow if they don't already.
Thanks. Yeah, if you're looking for a laugh, then I get myself into all kinds of funny positions to try and help demonstrate things, and my poor husband as well. You'll often see his hairy knees just to try and help people understand why certain things do certain things. Yeah, because often we sort of, you know, we see particular positions happening in birth, or we see particular ways of people doing things, and if we don't understand the effect that they're actually having on the body, then we may be going into a position or doing things in a certain way that's actually not helping the whole process. So having that understanding behind it is really helpful to understand what might be helpful, hence why I talk about these things in lectures and on social media and stuff.
So we're going to focus on breathing today, and as a hypnobirthing teacher, I'm particularly interested in this, and I'm sure I'm going to learn tons from you on this. I teach breathing techniques, but my knowledge of the in-depth biomechanics of it is probably not as in-depth as yours. So why is breath so important when we think about pregnancy and birth? How is one related to the other?
Yeah, so obviously we are all breathing all of the time. So it's a really helpful tool that is accessible for everybody to focus on breath. And it has, significant effects on what's happening within the body, within the physiology of how the baby is getting enough oxygen, how the uterus is getting enough oxygen, how we're feeling in terms of psychologically, the impact that it has on, we have a vagus nerve, which is really important in our parasympathetic nervous system. So the way that we breathe, even with just a few breaths, can completely change the way that we're feeling. And I've done a reel on this actually, where if you are in an environment where somebody takes a sudden deep breath in, like a It immediately affects your physiology. So with a single breath, you're then feeling in a kind of more heightened state, like a panic state, getting into more of a fight and flight state. And this is really important in birth because if we're getting adrenaline increasing in a birthing situation, it's reducing the oxytocin. So it's slowing the labor down. And that's intentional in the body because if the body thinks that you're in an unsafe place, it's not going to want to birth your baby because you don't want to have a vulnerable infant that needs you to care for it whilst you're in somewhere where your body is perceiving as dangerous. And on the flip side of that, we can also just with a few breaths take down somebody from feeling really in a heightened anxiety state. So we can use the breath to do that. And it's a helpful tool because everybody does it. If we weren't breathing, we wouldn't be here. So we can all do it. Whereas sometimes some of the other hypnobirthing tools may not be so as available to people, that people might struggle to kind of work with visualizations, or they might find that they can't really get on with affirmations or whatever it is. So it's probably the simplest of the tools that's part of hypnobirthing teaching that is much more available to everybody. And it's also much simpler to understand and teach. So it's like one of the sort of easy ways. And when we take a breath in, if we're taking short, sharp breaths in, what we're tending to do is breathing at the top of the chest. So we're using the upper respiratory muscles. So if you're doing a rapid breathing where you're coming in and out very quickly, you're using accessory muscles in the neck and the shoulders and things like that, as well as using the diaphragm. If we are taking a deeper and slower breath in, especially if we're lengthening the out breath, this helps to trigger the stimulate the vagus nerve, which is helping us to get more into the rest and digest and relaxation system in the body. So just by often in hypnobirthing things, people will say, breathe in for four and out for more. And the out for more doesn't really matter if it's for six or eight or even longer. If you can do a really long out breath, that's fine. But all that slower out breath just slows the heart rate. It reduces your blood pressure. It helps to your body to feel calmer. And I often just get people to do it, just to take a few breaths. Because if we did it now, if we take a nice deep breath in for four, and then we breathe out for more. Even with one breath, you straight away feel, oh, okay, my shoulders are relaxing. I'm feeling a lot calmer. So that's why it's important. Now, through pregnancy, the mechanics of breathing changes quite significantly. And the reason why that's happening is that there is a much higher oxygen demand on our body. Obviously, our uterus is going from a tiny, like shape of a pear, like kind of pear size, which before it's pregnant, to really expanding through the whole abdominal cavity and squishing the organs and actually the diaphragm up out of the way. And so it has an increased demand for need for oxygenation. And of course, the developing fetus and the baby needs oxygen as well. So we're not just breathing for ourselves, we're also breathing for our babies. And so what's called the tidal volume. So when we take a complete breath out, we can't actually empty all of the air out of our lungs. There's still a little bit resting in there at all times that is equal to the outside pressure of air. And then when we take a deep breath in, obviously we're expanding those lungs. So in pregnancy, even after the first trimester, that tidal volume, so that amount of air that we can have in drawing into the lungs, is actually increased by around 40%. So it's quite a significant increase even in that first trimester. And that's happening because of things going on. We've got increases in, changes in progesterone, changes in relaxin and stuff like that. And when we go into the third trimester, that capacity is increased even further, so that as the baby is expanding up and taking up more space in the abdomen, we're still able to get enough oxygen coming into the body to supply the baby and the uterus and us, obviously. Though our functional capacity reduces as we go, as the baby gets bigger and gets out of the way, the body's still trying to do things to make sure that we have that increase. So going from a non-pregnant body, we are able to have a tidal volume which is about 0.45 of a liter, so about 450 milliliters, I suppose, would be the right the right way to say it. And then in pregnancy, by the end of third trimester, it's gone up to 0.65. So there's quite a big, big increase in that to help with those things. And as the baby's getting bigger and the uterus is getting bigger and they're squashing up towards our diaphragm, what happens is our ribs actually, the angles of the ribs changes and the ribs actually flare out at the base and the diaphragm raises itself to allow for further space. And normally when I demonstrate this and when I'm doing lectures, I do it with a squishy ball, which I can show you, Erin, just in case, and maybe we can do a clip for Instagram if people want to see. But can you see that if you've got a tight rib angle that's squishing down like this, what happens is we get much more pressure coming out into the abdominal musculature and also a lot more pressure going down into the pelvic floor. And if we're not able to allow for that expansion of ribs, what happens is that people might then start to get issues with separation of the abdominal muscles at the front, excessive separation, and also with pelvic floor pressure issues. So increasing with things like hemorrhoids and stress incontinence. So, if you're stressing the pelvic floor, like by coughing or sneezing or something like that, that it's not able to do its normal function of holding those things inside. So actually having a good availability of flexibility and movement in the rib cage and the thoracic spine, so that's the part of the spine where the thorax is, where the rib cage is really helpful in terms of preventing issues that can happen sometimes in pregnancy that are thought sometimes to be normal in pregnancy, but they're not actually normal, if that makes sense. It's because there's a disruption in that ability for things to happen. So yeah, hope that's okay so far. Any
Yeah.
questions, just jump
So
in.
would practicing breathing techniques throughout pregnancy help with mobilizing the ribs and flaring the rib cage and having more flexibility?
Yes, absolutely. So if we are practicing how to breathe during pregnancy, it's helping to increase that mobility. And then we can also do movement to help increase flexibility if there's feeling of tightness. So side bending and lifting the arms up over the head and going to the side is really helpful, as well as rotation through the rib cage and helping to feel where are we are using the breath, where are we using the breath. So if, in fact, if everyone can do it now at home, and it's a really helpful thing to feel in yourself, because the learning is better when you're feeling what's going on in your body. So if you put a hand on your upper chest and then a hand on your tummy, and you can even close your eyes, so you're just really focusing on what you're feeling on your hands. When you take a breath in now, just feel what your feeling's moving. Is your belly really moving out forwards? Is your upper chest hand coming up? Okay, if you then change your hand position, so you're sort of holding around the base of your ribs and taking a breath in, are you feeling an expansion of your rib cage out there, or are you getting more of a push in the belly or a more of a raise in the chest? So that can give you an idea of what your natural resting mechanism of how your breathing is happening. So some people upper chest breathe a lot more than others. Some people will really push the belly out more than others. And some people will have greater expansion in the rib cage. So what we're trying to aim for really is a three-dimensional breath, 360-degree breath into the base of the ribs rather than into the abdomen. And I know some hypnobirthing scripts and things like that talk about breathing down to your belly, breathing down to your baby. Actually, what that is kind of encouraging us to do is to push the belly out, and which in turn is also pushing the pelvic floor down, which may actually not necessarily be helpful in terms of the dynamics and the pressure changes in the body. So it's actually better to focus more on the expansion of the ribs. And a way that can be really helpful is if you get if you've got a yoga strap at home or a scarf or a belt or a pair of tights even is perfectly fine. And if you wrap it around your lower rib cage, so I'll show you here because we're on the video for anyone. You just get a strap around the base of the rib cage, okay, and you can hold it tight. And then when you take your breath in, you're trying to push into the belt and noticing how much you're pushing forwards, how much is pushing out to the side, how much is pushing out to the back. And it can be really helpful to have that feedback from the ribs being slightly constricted by the belt or tights or whatever it is that you're using, to feel where it feels tight and it's not moving so well. And that can really help us to focus on being able to expand there more, rather than, say, upper chest breathing so much or breathing into the belly, to help get that the dynamics of pressure a little bit into a better rhythm, as it were. And if we are expanding in three dimension when we're taking a breath in, because when we breathe in, the diaphragm comes down, and at the same time, the pelvic floor comes down. Okay. So, and you can take some time to sit and feel that now if you want to. For those of you listening at home, even if you put your hand, even sit on your hand, so you're feeling your pelvic floor underneath your hand, and you can feel that when you take a deep breath in, you get this slight bulging of the pelvic floor, and then a lifting as the diaphragm's going up and down. So every time we're taking a breath in and a breath out, we're massaging all of the organs in the pelvis and in the abdominal cavity, and also the baby. If we are just upper chest breathing, what we're doing is expanding the upper ribs to make that space for the breath. And so what happens then is actually we get a lot of tightness in the upper chest and into the neck. So we have muscles called the scalenes and things that come up into the neck, which are helping to lift those upper ribs if we're desperately trying to get that sort of breath in, if we're frightened or we're trying to run away. But we don't want that mechanism to be there all of the time. Because what happens is that, give me 2 seconds because I've got some notes to make sure I don't miss anything, is that we're going to get neck pain and we get more of a stress response. And actually, if we're breathing in the upper chest, doing upper respiratory breathing, it also has an effect on our cognitive function because we're not getting as much oxygen into the body, and it creates an increase in cortisol, an increase in blood pressure, and an increase in heart rate, all of which are not very conducive to things going well in pregnancy and in birth. If we're doing that abdominal breath, so we're breathing, pushing our belly out, we're increasing the abdominal and the pelvic pressure. And so this can create more stress, which can cause more likelihood of hemorrhoids, prolapse, etc. If we're doing that optimal breathing, where we're expanding the rib cage, we're helping that thoracic mobility with every single breath that we're doing. So if you're finding that you are tense and doing upper chest breathing, or you're really pushing your belly out, just being mindful and taking a few minutes each day, even if you're just a few breaths before you go to sleep or when you wake up in the morning, to get into your routine to help feel what it feels like when you are doing a really good three-dimensional breath, then it means that you will then, it will become more of a habit, if that makes sense, in what you're doing, and can help all over in terms of helping the mechanics of the body working really well.
It's
Go ahead.
something that I am when I'm teaching breath work, when we're doing hypnobirthing, and it's not just with breath work, it's with everything with hypnobirthing. We talk a lot about the importance of practice, and I think breathing sounds like such a fundamental thing that you'd think we would all be doing it optimally, and not have to think about it. But actually, I mean, I know I definitely breathe with my upper half of my chest and my ribs. I don't really do deep breathing, and I'm highly strung all the time, which is probably goes hand in hand, but so I should probably be more mindful of this. But I think it is really important that if you're pregnant and you're going to be doing the breathing exercises, that you do try and practice them frequently. One of the things that I mentioned to my clients is that you don't want to be trying to practice and use some of these breathing techniques that you get taught in hypnobirthing, and the first time you do them is when you're giving birth. Because you're having to consciously think about, doing all of those things that you've just mentioned, being mindful about where you're breathing from, how long you're counting your breath, whether you're breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth, which is something else that we haven't touched on yet. All of these things while you're having contractions, while you're giving birth, and you want to be switching that mind off. You want it to be instinctive as possible. So practicing throughout pregnancy is really important, I think, so that it is instinctive when you go into labor.
Exactly. And it's a really helpful part of a relaxation process and trying to get into a space of calm, which is really what we want for labor, because the calmer you are, the easier it is for that oxytocin cycle to build up, and for the endorphins then to happen, so that you can relax and just basically fall into the birthing process and just let it happen in your body, so you're not fighting it like a tug of war. And if we're taking deep, slow breaths in, we're really expanding those ribs really well, and we're slowing down and having a longer out breath, it has a direct and almost immediate impact on increasing theta wave activity in the brain. So it's helping to shut down that like cognitive rushing and panicking and fight and flight and all that kind of thing, and just allowing the brain to free fall and think what it needs to think and just be more relaxed. And sometimes if people are struggling to get into a good breathing pattern. I don't know if it's something that you teach on your courses, but sometimes there's a kind of a box breath. So you're breathing in for a count of something, holding a full in breath for the count, breathing out for the same count, and then holding the empty for the count. And that can be a really helpful way of just putting a little stop and a pause in if things are kind of feeling out of control or difficult, just to help to bring slow like a slowing everything down and just bringing an alertness back to the breath. And it's not that you have to do that all the time, but it just can help to focus on it. And in birth, for example, if you are focusing on doing, so there's lots of different types of breathing, obviously, that people teach for different parts of labor. But when your uterus is drawing up to begin with, so at the where the cervix is dilating at the bottom and the fundus is drawing up at the top, and actually the drawing up of the fundus is what's opening the cervix. So it's more about what's happening at the fundus, and the cervix is the result of what's happening at the top, if that makes sense. With that, and so sometimes it's called up breathing because you're breathing for the uterus gathering up at the top. And so with that, what we're aiming for is a nice long, slow out breath. And often I describe the way that that I think of it is to imagine that somebody lovely has made you a birthing day cake. Yeah, so you've carried your baby for all of these days, but can sometimes feel like a very long 9 months or more, can't it? And so you definitely deserve a candle for each day that you've been pregnant, through all the nausea and the tiredness and all that kind of thing. So you deserve a really beautiful cake with lots of candles. And the reason why candles are helpful to imagine is that we don't want to blow too hard on those candles because we'd split wax all over our beautiful cake, but we just want to kind of slow the out breath, and it can help to visualize trying to blow out a candle for that kind of slowing down of the out breath to help have all those positive effects on the nervous system, on the oxygenation of the body, etc. So yeah, that can just be a helpful imagery tool if imagery feels like it's useful. But
I think
yeah,
that's a really
sorry.
I think that's a really good visualization actually, because it again when I'm teaching, I always mention about having a nice slow controlled exhale, because I've had clients who will do the breathing and I do in for four and out for more, and to be honest, I was taught to teach in for four, out for eight. But in reality, when somebody is, 40 weeks or thereabouts, they struggle with doing an out breath for eight, I think, because there's not as much lung capacity. So I tell them to just do whatever's comfortable as long as it's longer than your inhale. But you'll find that sometimes people will do a inhale through the nose for four, and then they'll breathe out quite forcefully, and they can't get to six or eight because they've just emptied out their lungs too fast. And it does need to be that slow, controlled exhale. So I think the candle visualization is a really nice one, which I think I might be adding to my toolkit, because I think because it is I think it's helpful to have something to force you to slow your breathing down. Otherwise, you do end up kind of going by the end, and you haven't got quite enough breath to get to that six or eight.
Yeah, and I think you made a really good point there about like not putting a number necessarily on the out breath, because then you also when in birth, when you're really wanting to not be cognitively thinking about a lot of things and wanting to relax, if you're sort of trying to count, sometimes it can be helpful. Some people find counting helpful, but sometimes actually it can be a bit too much because you're sort of staying in your head to do that count. Whereas if you're just having this visualization of this beautiful, gorgeous cake and all those candles that you're just gradually blowing them out. And when we're doing that with a three-dimensional breath, so on the breath in, the diaphragm and the pelvic floor are coming down, the ribs are expanding out. On the out breath, when we do a kind of slow, controlled breath out, what is happening is that we're getting this squeeze, gentle hugging in, like almost a corset of the transversus abdominis, so part of the abdominal muscles squeezing in very, very gently, and we get a slight lifting of the pelvic floor. Okay, and it's not a tension, it's not like a Kegel where we're trying to suck up the pelvic floor, it's just that lift as the diaphragm's lifting up with the change in pressure. So that's really what's happening with an up breath, and that kind of hugging, that gentle hugging of the body, of everything drawing into the core. So in pregnancy, that can be really helpful if you're feeling a bit unstable, if you've got pelvic girdle pain going on, or if you're feeling that your pelvic floor isn't feeling quite right. So if you're going to lift anything, like not necessarily that you're lifting weights, but if you're lifting, it's helpful for that too. But if you're picking up a toddler, or picking up a laundry basket or something like that, just being mindful of breathing out and just letting those abdominal muscles come in to kind of give you a corset to help support your low back and your body as a whole when you're going to lift something. And it's something that you can practice in terms of how it feels when you do it at home, just by lifting a big heavy book, see what difference it makes with that type of breath. And also see what difference it makes with the position that your ribcage is over your pelvis. So we're often told to stand up straight, that we're good to have good posture. And so when people are thinking about good posture, often what they do is sort of thrust their chest forward and like actively contract the muscles back. But when we're doing that, if we all do it now, like, because if you're trying to sort of thrust your chest out as an exaggeration, you can feel you start to get tension in the thoracic spine. You also get an overstretching of the abdominal muscles, which can then mean that if you're trying to lift something in that posture, you're more likely to have an injury to the abdominal muscles or a greater separation, especially when you've got a baby that's really expanded everything and stretched it to the limit anyway. We don't want to kind of further pull those apart and create a problem. If we're going at the kind of opposite end of the spectrum, so often a posture that people go into if they're feeling fearful, so I often think of like dogs. If they're nervous, they tuck the tailbone, the tail under, don't they? And we do it as well instinctively. If we're feeling frightened or threatened or under pressure, we tend to like curl forward into a more fetal position. And when you do that, if you then try to take a deep breath in and you try to lift something, you'll feel that the pressure on, especially on the back part of the pelvic floor, it's much more increased, and that can be why people are then getting problems with hemorrhoids and stuff like that happening, piles happening. So that's just an interesting point. So I'd like to touch on, if you don't mind, if it's not too technical, but the connection between the jaw and the pelvic floor, like through the whole connective tissue. So, people may have heard things like relax the jaw, relax the pelvic floor, floppy face, floppy fanny. And sometimes it can be a little bit of a stretch of the imagination to think, are they really linked? What does that? I'm not sure that really works, but actually embryologically, so when we were the fetus inside the body, or the embryo, in fact, at around day 15, during what's called the gastrulation phase of our formation from a couple of cells outwards, we get these two depressions which form next to one another. And one of them is the opening of the mouth at the top, and the other is the openings at the bottom. So for the rectal opening and for openings for the urethra and also the sexual organs. So to begin with, when we're being formed, they're really close together and then they gradually open out, but the connection between the two ends is there in fascia and connective tissue, so they are directly connected to one another. And I'm gonna get you all, everyone, to feel a little bit now something. If you take your thumb and put it just behind your top teeth, and push really strongly into the roof of your mouth there, see what you feel in your pelvic floor. When you push up in that roof of your mouth, most people will be able to feel like a tightening right at the front of the pelvic floor. So if you're a lady, that kind of near the clitoris and the urethra at the front, you feel this tension here. Mm-hmm. So that really highlights that just a change in pressure in the mouth really has an effect on the pelvic floor. So it's not kind of really out there and woo. When you actually experience it in your body, you can feel that there is a difference there. So we've got this embryological connection between our mouths and down through. We've got this fascial connection with the tension membrane between reciprocal tension membrane. So if we've got a torsion at the top part, it has an effect at the bottom and vice versa. Okay, and there's been some really interesting studies about various things with regard to this. So there was one study that highlighted that temporomandibular joint pain, so that's our jaw joint, basically. So just in front of your ears, if you kind of put your fingers right in front of your ears and you open and close your jaw, you can feel your TMJ joint there. So they found that if you have temporomandibular joint pain, so jaw pain, it directly correlates relates with hip movement. And so that if they worked on hips to help improve the hip mobility, the hip joint mobility, it had a positive effect on the jaw and vice versa. There was also another interesting study about obstructive sleep apnea. Oh, can't I say that five times quickly. and they found that it's really associated with irritable bladders. And that again is partly to do with the kind of breathing that people are doing with sleep apnea, where you're getting this kind of like sudden jolts and like tension that's happening in there, and that the two are associated. And also another study which was done in I think it was done in 2000 and then 2001 again, where they basically were showing people images, and when they showed scary images, basically you just sat there with lots of images flashing up very quickly, and they were recording the tension in both the pelvic floor activation and also in the upper back, they recognized that when there was something frightening, there was a significant increase in tension in the pelvic floor. So though we may not be consciously aware that these things are happening, they are. And that's really part of it being important in birth, that if we are frightened, it does cause a tension in the pelvic floor. So if we can do things to help us relax, including using the breath, it really helps things to work a little bit better. So what can we do if we're feeling, because actually a lot of us have a lot of tension in our pelvic floor and we don't even realize that we're doing it. You know, as women, we're taught that we've got to suck everything in, you know, thin, tight thing, you know, everything being tight is supposedly better. It's like the aim, which isn't necessarily true. And actually often a lot of issues like stress incontinence are caused by it being too tight in particular areas of the pelvic floor, rather than it being loose and floppy, which is of course what everybody thinks. You know, oh well, everything's going to get overstretched and floppy and that's going to be a problem. But actually it's an imbalance often between too much tension. So often people are so used to sucking in their belly, holding everything in, sucking up their pelvic floor, because you know you're taught to do a Kegel and you're supposed to like hold everything in, that actually often there's tension in the pelvic floor that people don't even realize is there. And what we need for birth is for the pelvic floor to relax as much as possible, because the baby's head has to come through it. So all of the muscles in the pelvic floor, which are actually more like a bowl than a floor in itself. So for example, there's a muscle called the levator ani muscle, which is a bit like a almost like a rainbow around the back part of the pelvic floor. The baby's head has to come through and stretch through there. Okay. If you are tensing your pelvic floor, or if you're being directed to push and do a Valsalva maneuver to bear down, in about 60% of the population, people will co-contract their levator ani. So they will actually tense that muscle when they're trying to push down, which means that they then have to push harder in order for a baby to be able to come out, and are more likely to cause injury. So it's actually not helpful to do, if that makes sense. So what can we do to relax it? We can do things like doing horse lips, which I'll
I find that really hard
of,
to do. Whenever I say horse lips, it makes me laugh, and then I can't do the horse lips, and it makes my mouth really itch as well.
Just the thought of doing it. I had a client once who just found it really helpful. She was like, she's saying in her mind, she's saying, I was saying floppy face, floppy fanny, and doing the horse lips is really working for me. Some people are just going to be too embarrassed to do it. Mm. And the thing is, you don't want to be doing something that's making you nervous. Yeah. So, you know, that's why there's so many different techniques and things that you can do, and some work for you and some don't. And that's absolutely fine. But with the horse lips, which are quite funny, what we're doing is having the jaw is relaxed, so that's going to help the pelvic floor to relax. The lips are just closed, so they're not being pursed closed. And like we were feeling with pushing the thumb behind the teeth, if we're pursing the lips closed, if you do it, might try and purse your lips, you can also feel there's like a kind of reciprocal pursing in the pelvic floor. So it helps to stop that, because often if we're nervous or we're feeling too much pain, we tense up against it. Mm-hmm. So this is literally like wobbling somebody helps them to relax, like having a bit of a wobble, doing the wobble with it helps. And as you're exhaling through the mouth, it helps the lips to vibrate and relax, which then in turn helps the pelvic floor to relax. So everyone can have a go at home. Maybe Erin and I won't do it and embarrass ourselves.
I just can't do it because you can't do it when you're laughing. No. because when you smile, your mouth is stretched, and then I can't do. I find it really hard to do horses. But I mean, it can be a really, really good tool, I think, to use during labor. But it's just something that I wouldn't. It's not a tool that I would be able to use, because it just makes me giggle because I'm just a child.
But in a way, that's a helpful tool in itself, because when you're laughing, it's going to boost oxytocin. And when you're laughing, have you ever laughed so hard that you pee? Because the laughing means that your pelvic floor is relaxing as well. So actually, if all you get out of horslips is a bit of a giggle, that's probably going to help you anyway. So it's a double, doubly good in a
Double
way.
whammy.
Yeah, exactly. And then we can also use the breath to help to focus where if we've got discomfort. So you can breathe into an area of discomfort. So I often describe this like, so if you're thinking about, for example, stretching out the hamstrings, so the muscles in the back of your thigh, they're a good one because everyone can sort of feel when they've got a bit of a stretch in the hamstring, because it's a really big muscle. So it's an easy one to think of. And so if you are trying to get to the biggest extent of a stretch that you can in your hamstrings, basically you can go quite far in the flexibility of your hamstrings, but then when you're getting towards that very end of range and you're trying to stretch it, it becomes increasingly more uncomfortable. And then at that last little bit of stretch, it's going to be incredibly more uncomfortable. And it's how in labor, when labor's happening and the cervix is dilating, so all throughout pregnancy, that cervix is being held really tightly closed to keep your baby in there, and it's facing more towards the back. But during labor, what's ha happening, and in the lead up to labor, with the changes that are happening, is that those tight muscular fibers are breaking down, releasing, relaxing, softening, and so the cervix is going to open. Okay, and usually the most uncomfortable part of labor often is when we're getting that last bit of dilation, because it's the biggest extent of stretch that muscle has been holding really tight, and then it's having to relax and let go and open, and being drawn open by the fundus. So it's why that kind of transition period, when we're going from kind of 8 to 10 centimeters ish, feels so intense, feels probably the most difficult part of labor. As well as the body giving us a bit of a boost of adrenaline, because it's trying to check in, is this a safe time to give birth to this baby? Because if not, I'm going to stop dilating here. So we get this kind of combination of it doing the biggest stretch it can, and us getting a boost of adrenaline, which is reducing our oxytocin and endorphins. So it's all happening quite intensely at one point. But if we can understand what's happening, it can be easier to relax into it. So if we're thinking it's doing that last bit of stretching, it's trying to. If you're trying to stretch your hamstrings, just reach that last little bit towards your toes. What we can do is use the breath to help relax. So take a nice deep breath in, and then as we breathe out, when we relax into it, we can get that little bit more stretch. And the same thing can happen in birth. So often, if somebody's getting tense, you're seeing their shoulders go up towards their ears, they're starting to go up on their toes a little bit because they're trying to reduce the pressure through the posterior part of the pelvic floor by shortening that back chain of the body. If you're seeing someone do that, just taking a nice deep breath, putting hands on the shoulders if someone's comfortable for you to do so, to help relax into it, can really make a big difference and help to ease the discomfort.
And what about breathing for the expulsive phase when you're getting the urge to bear down? So we kind of touched on it a little bit about, guided pushing and the Valsalva technique, which is kind of lying on your back and being guided to push, which we don't want ideally. So what breathing techniques should someone be doing when they're, because it's, I think the breathing is different, isn't it, from the dilation phase to the bearing down birthing phase.
Yeah, the breathing is a little bit different, but in a way, actually quite similar. So, where we were thinking about taking a breath in and expanding in a three-dimensional way, we still want to do that. Often people will find that they take a breath in a bit more quickly, okay, because it's less about trying to relax and more about making sure that you've got enough oxygenation happening. At this point in labor, it's the most intense point. The uterus is working its hardest, and also where it's squeezing really hard to try and push the baby down, we're getting that squeezing is happening to the baby and also to the placenta at the same time. So the baby's coming through the tightest part of the pelvis, so it's the most stressful part of the labor for them. Okay, and it's naturally meant to be a bit stressful, because that stress means that then when they come out, They've gone from being in a very oxytocin high state of oxytocin and having their energy hungry cells of their brain shut down so that they can cope with the hypoxia of labor. Okay, because when the uterus and the placenta are being squeezed, the baby's getting less oxygen. So it's very normal for their heart rate to dip down and then come back up again. And that it's also normal for that to become more intense as we're getting to the pushing phase where the baby's coming through the tightest part of the pelvis. So it's a normal part of birth. And the baby's physiology is designed to handle that if they're having a physiological birth. Okay. Where it often becomes a problem is if you are not having a physiological birth and your labor's being augmented. So there's usually a feedback mechanism happening. So if the contraction is too much, it's too intense for your body, your body slows it down. If it's too intense for your baby, your body also slows it down. So there's communication happening. That's stopped if you have an epidural, so that communication back up to slow the labor is stopped. And with synthetic oxytocin, they're titrating it in an IV. So you're not getting this peak and trough like you do with the natural, the endogenous oxytocin, which is made in your body. They turn it up to what they consider to be effective labor. So that may be usually three contractions in 10 minutes or a little bit more. So for some people that's a fine amount of labor, and some babies that's fine, but for some people that would be too much for them. And so when we get to the pushing phase in physiological labor, often we get a contraction and then we get a much bigger space in between the contractions, and that's for everything to reperfuse, for the baby to get enough oxygen, for us the uterus to get enough oxygen, so it's then ready for the next contraction. So between contractions, people just breathe normally and don't need to think about it. Your body will naturally increase the in-breath if you need more oxygen to recover for both you and your baby. Then when you are breathing during a contraction, so if people are just left physiologically undisturbed to birth, what they tend to do is that they don't actually start actively pushing, engaging in a push with the uterus until the contraction has almost reached the peak. Okay. And then they will tend not to push for more than 5 seconds. And they will tend to do about 5 to 6 pushes in one contraction. Okay. So it means that the people are breathing and getting enough oxygen in to help the uterus work well and to help get oxygen to the baby, which is very different to directed pushing. Which is often happening when somebody's got an epidural, so the person's not feeling the contraction very well and somebody's watching on a monitor for when the contraction is happening. And often what will happen is go, right, the contraction is happening, start pushing now. So people are forced to push even before the contraction is built up, which is not a natural physiological pattern. So you're then increasing the downward pressure onto the pelvic floor, and it's actually increasing the pressure on the pelvic floor for a longer period of time than it would be in a natural physiological birth, which is an issue because it then interrupts the perfusion of blood flow to the pelvic floor and means that you're more likely to get issues with tearing and stuff like that, because the tissue becomes more friable when the blood flow is squeezed out like that. So it's better for them self-directed pushing even with an epidural than it is to have coached pushing. Okay, because the baby's getting better oxygen, your body's getting better oxygen. And actually, in terms of outcomes, that, you know, the research, though the quality of research is not brilliant, it really shows that, you know, you don't get more babies that need resuscitating if you're just breathing your baby out compared to active pushing. What you do get is more problems. And we can talk about those in more detail, but if you're birthing physiologically, you will just breathe how you need to breathe. You don't need to think about it. If your baby is struggling to come down and you're having some issues with that and you're having to put more pressure in, it's a similar breath to before. So we're taking that big expansion with the breath in three dimensionally in the rib cage, and then as you're breathing out and your uterus is contracting down, we're wanting the uterus to do most of the work. Yeah, so we just want to make sure that we're not holding tension so that the baby can push down in the pelvic floor and then the perineum can stretch. And when you're breathing out and you're getting that corseting of the transverse abdominal muscle as it's coming in, that is going to help that downward pressure that's happening with the uterus. Yeah. What we don't want to do is like be flexing chin to chest, which is often what's told in directed pushing. Mm-hmm. Okay, because then we're curling over the baby. Okay, and you remember before when we were talking about that, if you flex forward into that protective posture, what happens is you get a lot more pressure on the posterior part, on the back part of the pelvic floor. So, and that's also a bit like that pushing into your bottom. It's like, hello, hemorrhoids. Yeah, if I'm forcibly trying to push towards the rectum and flexing forward. And also when we're curling over like that, what's happening is that we're reducing the space between the rib cage and the pelvis. So the baby has less space to maneuver and wriggle. The baby's not passive in birth. They move and wriggle to fit through the space that is right for them in whatever way is right for them. So if we're compressing that space, it means that they can't wriggle and move as much as they need to be able to get into the space, and you're more likely to end up with shoulder dysostosis and things because the baby's not able to move in between, if that makes sense. So yeah, with that out breath, we're just feeling that course of the body drawing in, which is helping the uterus to push the baby down, if that makes sense. And
Now,
so some people, sorry, go
sorry,
on.
I was just going to ask that when people are having guided pushing, or we call it, some of us call it purple pushing, your face goes purple when you're being guided to push. And you're right, you're usually on your back, you put your chin to your chest, and they tell you to put your chin to your chest, tell you to take a big deep breath in and then hold your breath. The holding of the breath is also not helpful, is it? And counting to 10 and then pushing with force while you're holding your breath.
Exactly, because then you've only got one lung full of air, and so the oxygen in that lung full of air runs out quite quickly. So it's going to make it more likely that the baby's going to become distressed. It also makes it more likely that you're going to become tired out and not be able to push anymore because your uterus has not been oxygenated in the way that it should do. So you shouldn't do any breath holding for more than 5 seconds. And if people are physiologically birthing, they naturally won't hold their breath for longer than 5 seconds at a time. Whereas with the directed pushing, and it's called purple pushing because you're increasing the venous pressure up towards your head. It's why you turn purple, because you're like basically stopping the blood flow from going anywhere. It's just static wherever it is during that pressure phase. You're reducing that oxygenation to the baby, and creating pressure in ways that's not really helpful. And I mean, in terms of outcomes with directed pushing compared to physiological pushing, so like I say, the research is not brilliant and sometimes it's variable. So sometimes some research shows one thing and some research shows another. But basically, if you have directed pushing, you are increasing the likelihood that you're going to end up with an episiotomy. Okay. You are increasing the likelihood that you're going to have perineal damage. Like I say, because of that friability of the tissues that happens. You're therefore increasing your likelihood that you're going to need sutures because, of course, that damage is more likely to happen. You're significantly increasing the likelihood of pelvic structural damage with directed pushing. The time pushing, this is often the thing that is used as an, well, it's quicker if you do that. Okay. So, yes, in terms of the amount of average time that it takes for a third stage to happen for a baby to be born, if you are doing directed pushing, on average, compared to both groups, physiological and directed pushing, the pushing phase takes around about underneath for most people 2 hours. Okay, so it can be up to 2 hours, usually in multipara. So when you're having your second or subsequent baby, it can often be faster. Okay, because the body's just knows what it's doing a little bit more, is able to expand more easily, all that kind of thing. So in terms of over the space of 2 hours, directed pushing may on average make birth quicker by 13 minutes. So with 120 minutes, 13 minutes is actually not that big a difference in terms of actually the overall time it takes. So it does make it a bit faster, but actually in the making it faster, what you're doing is increasing that pressure and increasing that deoxygenation by holding that Valsalva, that tense position, holding the breath, etc. And you're increasing that deoxygenation and that increased pressure over 60% more than when you are birthing physiologically. So you are increasing the stress to the baby, to your pelvic floor structures, everything. 60% of the time, when actually you're only reducing the amount of time it takes by 13 minutes over a 2 hour period. So the compromise is really not in a good favor, if that makes sense. And that's shown by then Apgar scores of babies when you're doing directed Valsalva pushing. They are worse than when you have physiological birth, irrelevant of the circumstances that are happening. Okay. You're also increasing the chance of having increased decelerations in heart rate of the baby. So the baby's like letting you know if you're looking, I am struggling with this kind of behavior compared to if a baby's being born physiologically. You also, in some studies, they showed that you get an increase in meconium presence with directed pushing. Okay, some studies they didn't. So again, you know, sometimes that's thought of as being a stress response from a baby. Okay, you also get a significant increase in the stretch of the urethra if you're doing directed pushing. So if you're tucking the chin to your chest and you're doing this kind of forced pushing, you get a much greater stretch on the maternal urethra. So you're then more likely to have more incontinence problems, etc., post birth because of that. Just trying to think what else. You also, in some studies, they showed that you get increased maternal blood loss. And let's see what else is there.
I mean, it kind of makes you wonder. And I ask this question with pretty much every practice when it comes to birth. Why? I know it's quicker, but I mean the payoff that you get, that 13 minutes, it just seems bonkers. It just,
yeah.
And I think, I don't know, like I said, I mean, I ask this with quite a lot of practices when it comes to birth and the interventions and procedures that are so common and part of policy. But it just blows my mind. You know, every time I record a podcast episode and I talk to somebody about the biomechanics or the physiology or the, you know, the psychology, everything is designed, unsurprisingly, to work, right? And work together in a way that means that we end up with a healthy baby and a mother in one piece. And I get why we have these medical interventions and why we intervene, because sometimes they're necessary, but vast majority of circumstances not necessary, and we just need to leave the hell alone and let people. I mean we've done an entire podcast episode on breathing, which is really, you know, useful and important and definitely a tool for people to know how to use. But like you were saying earlier, lots of people instinctively do certain things if they're just left alone. But because we don't leave people alone, they need to almost relearn how to do a lot of this stuff, because it doesn't come naturally, or because we are told to do the direct polar opposite of what we would be doing instinctively. And it just, sorry, I was a little rant. It just blows my mind a little bit that things work quite well if we just left the hell alone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head there, really. And the thing is, when we are taking people out of instinctual birthing postures, so instinctively, most people will birth on hands and knees. So when you're in a hands and knees position, it's like being in a squat, but you're not actively holding the pelvic floor to hold the body up and stabilize. And so it increases the dimensions within the pelvis massively, especially in the mid and lower pelvis. So in the mid pelvis, for most people, it's around about 2.5 centimeters, an increase in the tightest spot in the pelvis. And then in the outlet, it's at least I think it's a couple of centimeters now. I'd have to look at my notes, but you know, you're getting this passive increase in space that is compared to lying on your back on a bed. So if you're lying on your back on the bed, you're working against gravity, because your baby's not basically just falling out with the use of gravity as being upright. You have got the sacrum and coccyx fixed, and so the baby's having to go uphill to navigate around those and around the pubic symphysis at the front. The baby's head has to arch around the pubic symphysis. And so it's all trying to happen uphill. So you need to use more force for a baby to be able to be born in that way than you would do if somebody's just kneeling on all fours. And so it then therefore increases the need for directed pushing, because things are happening more slowly. You're on your back, so you're more likely to be compressing your vena cava, and so the blood flow is disrupted, and so the baby's more likely to look like they're being distressed on a monitor, etc., etc. I mean, there's so many things that tie in and compound the problem that just wouldn't exist if we weren't interfering in the first place, if that makes sense.
I feel like this conversation can go off in a million different million different directions, because I mean, there's so many things that I'm personally interested in which we've kind of touched on, which I think deserve a whole separate podcast episode. I mean, you talking about the connective tissue just made me go ping, Bowen therapy, because my quite a lot of my family are Bowen therapists and they work with connective tissue and so on. And it amazes me how the body works and how literally everything is interconnected. And like I said earlier, how there's the smallest of thing, like being told to change your position, or just how you're feeling emotionally will really, really seriously impact your birth, and the progression, the physiology, the psychology, how it all works together. But I'm gonna say, I think we've covered quite a lot with the birth, with the breath work, and it's fascinating. You have so much more knowledge to share. I feel like we need to do more podcast episodes later. But if anybody wants to hear more of your amazing knowledge on biomechanics and birth and doulaing and everything else that you share, where can they find you? Where can anybody come and absorb as much of your knowledge as possible?
Okay, I'll tell you that in 2 seconds, but I want to just finish with one point from
Yes, go ahead.
research that I think ties up what we've been talking about. So this is from the Cochrane Review in 2017, which is the latest one. So with or without epidural, I'm just going to say that again, with or without epidural, there is no conclusive evidence to support or refute any specific styles as part of routine clinical practice. And in the absence of strong evidence supporting a specific method of timing of pushing, the woman's preference and comfort and clinical context should guide decisions. Okay, so even if you have an epidural, you do not have to have directed pushing. And they will tell you, when you're 10 centimeters dilated because you can't feel it or what have you. So I'm just gonna, my light's flickering like mad at me. There we go. So they will be feeling, if you're having an augmented and medicalized birth, will be feeling when the cervix is dilated to let you know. Okay, but they might feel it and it actually might have dilated half an hour ago to 10 centimeters. We just don't know. And they've now started to introduce a practice of what's called laboring down. So basically just waiting for your uterus to contract at the fundus to push your baby down lower into the pelvis. Okay, and they used to allow an hour, some places they allow 2 hours. The longer that you can advocate for just letting your uterus do what it wants to do, the better, because you might not need to actively push at all. If you're in a coma, your baby will just come out. You don't have to actively do anything. And when we're actively doing stuff and being directed by somebody out of our body, that's when it starts to cause more problems. If there's no distress in a baby and a mother, there's no reason to start interfering. It can just be left. And it also gives a chance for an epidural to wear off a bit more, which actually is really helpful in terms of the physiological peaks of oxytocin and stuff for nurturing behaviors for mothers and babies. Okay, I'm going to stop lecturing you now.
No,
I
that
just
is a
wanted to
really
sort of
important
point
point,
out
because
that, yeah,
I
that
think that
even with epidural, you don't need to do this kind of breathing.
I think that's actually a really important point, which is that it's the time limits that are put on birth are really, really problematic. Everything is always in a state of urgency, in a state of rush, or there's your clock watching, or not the you, but the hospital, the medical professional is clock watching, and that can be really stressful, I think, when you feel like you're on a time limit, and if you haven't given birth by this certain point, or you haven't got to have many centimeters by a certain point, or you have restrictions or put on you, and I think it's hopefully reassuring for somebody who is pregnant and listening to this to hear that actually all being well, and as if baby's happy and you're happy and things are progressing, we don't need to worry about the time limits, because they cause unnecessary stress. And it's with everything, isn't it? It's with your due date, it's with how long you're pushing for, it's for how long the various stages of labor happen, for how long it takes for your placenta to come out, because we all know that that is a real issue when it comes to giving birth. The time that it takes a placenta to come out causes all sorts of stress for medical professionals. Just need to just let things happen as they want to happen in the time it needs for the body to do it. And And if there's concern and there's red flags and baby looks distressed, then we intervene. But if not, then we just let the body do what it needs to do.
Yeah, exactly. And this is too much to talk about because we haven't even talked about different sounds and how they have an impact. So we'll have to do a follow-up, won't we?
Yes, that's very true, actually. And there's also something that I talk about, you know, we don't high-pitched noises. We want to avoid stressing the vocal cords and triggering the sympathetic nervous system. I always tell my clients to do non-tuneful humming if they want to consciously make noise. Doesn't have to make a tune, but keeping your vocal cords relaxed and triggering the parasympathetic nervous system. But I feel like we could like I said, I think we could talk forever, couldn't we?
yeah, we kept people too long. They need to go now. But in order to find me, I'm the Serenity Doula on all social medias and all social medias. I sounded very old when I said that, making it a plural. On the social medias. And also my web address is the Serenity doula.co.uk, and if you want to email me, you can email me Shelley@the Serenity Doula, which is Shelley spelled Shellie, if you have any questions. And I actually have bite-sized birth lectures available, and there is one of them all about breathing. So if you want to hear a bit more detail about it, you can purchase my bite-sized birth lectures. They're £10 each. And I also obviously run courses, birthing biomechanics courses, where I cover a lot of this stuff, both an online version, which is recorded lectures, and also in person. So if you've got a group of birth workers in your area and you'd like me to come and teach you, and you've got a lounge that we can all sit in, then do, because it's really lovely for everyone to get together. It's a great way of getting to know people and to learn. And if people have any questions or want to spend any time learning from me, then I offer Zoom sessions for a set price for an hour, and we can talk about anything: biomechanics, hypnobirthing, birth preferences, making your own birth plan, whatever it is, a stressful appointment that you've had that you want to know more about your rights and stuff like that. So I also offer that service as well.
Thank you so much, Shelley, for today. And I feel like once we finish recording, I'll have to schedule another podcast episode to pick up where we left off. But thank you for coming and sharing all your lovely knowledge.
Oh, thanks for having me, Erin. It's been really lovely to chat with you.
Oh.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.